I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm Alan Kohler.
In 2026, business big and small is moving at a rapid pace. And ABC Business Daily is here to help you cut through the noise and spin, Monday to Thursday.
And on Friday, I sit down with business leaders, founders, creators, change makers, and those in the know to ask them how they see the world, because that's business.
All in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
I had rather thought that I would celebrate my 100th birthday quietly, but it seems that many of you have had other ideas.
From Wandjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, Sir David Attenborough turns 100 years old. Today we're going to take a look back through the life of the remarkable broadcaster, and we're going to hear from one of his collaborators.
It's always a delight to be able to say, he is exactly like you think he is. There's no skeletons in the cupboard. He's a lovely man. He's actually very funny. His the stories of Daring Do, and some of them are pretty hair-raising, actually, but they're hilarious. He's got great comic timing.
More anecdotes shortly from the creative director of the BBC's Natural History Unit. Then, on any other day, we would be leading with this story. Plenty of developments regarding the Strait of Hormuz. We'll walk you through the latest and just what one former diplomat thinks about the prospects of a deal.
We've heard this before, Sally. I'm not breaking open the champagne.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. All right, so I promise The Breakfast Wrap isn't turning into a tribute show. Yesterday we did mark the death of CNN founder Ted Turner, and today we are paying tribute to the very much alive David Attenborough. Now, I know that's not what everyone thought when they saw headlines about the broadcaster.
And Sally, I don't know about you, every time David Attenborough's face pops up in the news, my knee-jerk reaction is, oh no, is he dead? He's not dead. He's turning 100.
Life Matters host Tegan Taylor there saying what a few people may have thought. So today, Sally made sure to celebrate this legend on his 100th birthday, because in his career spanning more than seven decades, David Attenborough has transformed the way that we see the planet, not just as a place of wonder, but also as something fragile and in need of protecting. So today, as the world celebrates Sir David Attenborough's 100th birthday, we took a look back through his remarkable career.
After living for nearly 100 years on this planet, I now understand the most important place on Earth is not on land, but at sea.
After an hour, I found on the forest floor the rinds and cores of durian fruit, which I knew was the favourite food of the orangutan.
There is more meaning and mutual understanding in exchanging a glance with a gorilla than any other animal I know.
And as it tilts its 100-ton body downwards, so it can plunge to the black world 500 feet or more below the surface. This is one of the most spectacular, complex, but fragile ecosystems in the world, the Great Barrier Reef. 60 years ago, I dived on the reef for the first time, and ever since, it has held a deep fascination for me. It's certainly true that I have been extremely fortunate to spend my life traveling the world to film and share the wonders of nature. I've witnessed the natural world at its most fascinating and vibrant. But I've also witnessed startling changes, changes that are today threatening our very civilizations.
Never before have we had such an awareness of what we are doing to the planet. And never before have we had the power to do something about that.
For if we save the sea, we save our world. After a lifetime of filming our planet, I'm sure that nothing is more important.
And that was the brilliant Brooke Young that put all that together. Few people have worked as closely with Sir David Attenborough over the years as Mike Gunton. He is the creative director of the BBC's Natural History Unit. He was the executive producer on numerous landmark Attenborough series, including Planet Earth 2, Dynasties, and also the green planet. This morning you joined Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast.
How do you reflect on the life of Sir David Attenborough as he celebrates his 100th birthday today?
Well, actually, listening to those clips was a lovely trip down memory lane. Obviously, some of those happened long before I started working with him, but you did have a great collection there of the whole range from the beginnings all the way up to the latest thing he's just recently done. And I think those clips said it all. He has seen so much of our world, has told us how wonderful it is, but also is reminding us that despite its wonders, it is a fragile place. And, you know, what more can you ask? I think it's been a remarkable journey for him. And we're all lucky to have been with him.
Listening to some of his narration there as well, Mike, it is a reminder that, you know, he's been heard widely across the planet, and the message that he's delivering is vitally important. But often he's heard because that message is delivered in a whisper, in great intimacy, when he's surrounded by that environment, those creatures, that fauna.
You're absolutely right. Again, if you take that journey you've just made with those clips, even when he was like slightly posh voice back in the 50s, even then he had this fantastic way of communicating with audiences. And as his career's progressed, audiences have come to love him in a way and trust him as almost like their favorite uncle. And he has this fantastic ability to make you feel like you're with him and he's only speaking to you. And that obviously the voice itself is a lovely voice, but there's something about the way he engages with you through the camera, which is a gift that very, very few people have. And he has used it to such effect. You know, it's been fantastic. And great to work with him. When you see him in operation doing it, it is pretty impressive.
I was going to ask you as well, I mean, I'm trying to fashion beautiful questions for you, but also I think the thing that people want to know is, what's he like?
Well, I get that asked a lot, and it's always a delight to be able to say, he is exactly like you think he is. There's no skeletons in the cupboard. He's a lovely man. He's actually very funny. I mean, people often say, what's my favourite memories? And generally, it's of course, being on location and seeing the animals and filming the animals is why we're there. But the best bits often, the camera box is shut, the cameras are put away, we go back to the campfire or the lodge or whatever, the beers come out and we chat about what we've done today, the day, or things that we've seen in the past. And he's seen so many things and he's experienced so many things, his stories, his anecdotes, the stories of daring do. And some of them are pretty hair-raising actually, but they're hilarious. He's got great comic timing. And you can see that in some of the things he does, you know, some of them are serious, but some of them, he absolutely relishes the humour of nature, because some of the things animals do are quite absurd, really.
How do you choose for these series which species, which moment, which aspect of them to tell a broader story? And how do you get that particular footage? Because there'll be a camera operator who is tasked with seeing this particular species mate or reproduce or die or metamorphose. How do you put all that together?
Well, a lot of it actually is down to the scientists. You know, we have such we owe so much to the scientific community. They are out there studying these animals, exploring them, dedicating their lives to understanding them, and they're so generous with their knowledge. They tell us about it. And of course, when we start one of these projects, you could more or less film anything, but you have a theme that you want to follow, and you have your particular types of animals you think would be best to tell those stories. And so you kind of spread the word out in the scientific community, and the stories come out and they return, and you look through and think, well, that's possible to do that one, that would be, you know, it's quite tricky to do that one, oh, that's really hard, or actually nobody's seen that before, let's go and do that. You know, those are the sorts of decisions you make. Often actually, has David seen it before? Because that's quite a high bar, because he's seen a lot of things. So if you can say, no, he doesn't know that story and he's never seen that animal, that probably gets in the script.
How much is grace a part of who Sir David Attenborough is?
Grace? What do you mean? Sorry, I didn't understand.
Being gracious,
that. Sorry?
In the way that he's very
gracious. Being
gracious.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, he's a product of his time in some ways, but he's an absolute gentleman, and politeness and behaving properly is a very important part of that. But it's also about respect, and I think he has a huge respect for the audience. And one of the things I've learned from him is, apart from being to be constantly curious, is that do not underestimate the audience. The audience absolutely have a real appetite to learn, to be engaged, to be enthralled. You know, don't dumb down. They want to be challenged. They want to be wowed. And he often says, you know, if you believe this is, if you feel it's fascinating, if you believe it's wonderful, if you believe it's important, they will too have that confidence. And that is part of that graciousness, I think you're referring to. It's a very powerful tool.
We've only got 30 seconds to go. How much of an honour has it been for you working with David?
I can't believe my luck, actually. You know, when I started working with him, he was supposedly going to make his last series. I'd started in my 20s, and the series I was going to work on, I wanted to work on it because he said, I'm going to stop. That was in 1987. Here we are, what is it, 40 years later? And thankfully, he has kept going. And it has been the joy of my, and many others, I mean, not by no means, many others have done the same, has had the same pleasure as I have. To work with him has been an absolute honour, pleasure and joy.
Mike, it's been a delight to have you on this morning. Best wishes to Sir David Attenborough celebrating 100 years. Thank you very much.
I'm seeing him tonight. I'll pass that on.
Please
Thank you very
do.
Much.
I don't think it gets any better than that. A date with David Attenborough. Mike Gunton is the creative director of the BBC's Natural History Unit, talking to us on David Attenborough's 100th birthday. Well, let's turn to major developments overseas because there are really conflicting messages coming out of the Strait of Hormuz. The US and Iran have exchanged fire, with each side accusing each other of being the instigator. Iran this morning accused the US of breaching the ceasefire by firing on two Iranian vessels and carrying out strikes with the help of regional allies on civilian sites as well. Things developed really quickly this morning, so right before the end of the show, our business and economics correspondent, Carrington Clark, who is also a former North America correspondent, gave us an update on Donald Trump's response to that claim that the US breached the ceasefire.
The language that's been used by the US President Donald Trump describing these retaliatory strikes, or so America's claims they're retaliatory strikes against Iran, as just a love tap. Now, what appears to have occurred, and again, there are conflicting reports from Iran and the US about who started this latest round of fire. Iran claims two of its ships were targeted by the US, as well as civilian targets, they say, in Tehran, the capital, and some southern Iranian cities. Iran then says it attacked US assets. The US instead says that their assets were attacked first and they have retaliated against Iran. Now, Iran says that this is a violation of the ceasefire agreement. It seems very clear that America does not want to call it a violation of the ceasefire, which is probably why the markets are shrugging this off, because Donald Trump does not want this to escalate into full-blown war. And there's a few reasons that that might be the case. One, of course, is that we're less than 6 months now to the US midterm elections. He knows that this war is deeply unpopular. He knows that Americans are very upset about how much they're paying for fuel and how they're starting to see inflation pressures elsewhere in the economy. He also has this long-anticipated trip to China, where he's supposed to be meeting with President Xi. He's also supposed to be taking along some heavyweights of US industry, including chip manufacturer Nvidia CEO, the head of Boeing, etc. This was supposed to be a big grand statement of America's power on the global stage. China is not happy with the Strait of Hormuz being shut off to traffic because it is a major purchaser of Iranian oil in normal times and is understood to be uneasy about the idea of hosting Donald Trump while there is live conflict between Iran and the US. So we shall see. It's been a kind of sketchy few hours here as we've been watching to see whether or not this would escalate further. At this point, at least, America is saying that they are wanting to de-escalate the situation. Let's see if that holds. But of course, it calls into question at the start of the program we were talking about, are we on the road to a peace agreement? This just goes to show how fragile even the ceasefire agreement is, let alone getting Iran and the US to agree on ending this war completely.
Carrington Clark there. So that progress towards an agreement that he mentioned at the end, that is where we started our show this morning. But despite the positive words coming out of Washington and Tehran saying that they're mulling a proposal, our first guest wasn't so optimistic. and he's worth listening to because he's no stranger to these dynamics. Alan Eyre is a former US diplomat, and he was a senior member of President Barack Obama's negotiating team for the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Here's what he told Sally about Washington touting progress on a deal. And mind you, this was hours before Iran accused the US of breaching the ceasefire.
We've heard this before, Sally. I'm not breaking open the champagne. Even if they agree on this one-page document, that signals the start of negotiations, not the end of it. So I hope they agree on this one-page document. But if they do, there's still a long road ahead.
There's an article on the front page of the Washington Post this morning saying that US intelligence believes that Iran can outlast Donald Trump's Hormuz blockade for months. What's your analysis on whether it will take a much longer period of time for this blockade to truly pressure Iran?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's what's called a two clocks issue. The blockade of Iranian ports is hurting Iran. But then again, the Iran is not heading into elections like the U.S. It's being run by a military cabal, so they can take a lot more pain. On the other side, the Strait of Hormuz, which has been closed now for a long time, every day the economic pain is compounding almost exponentially. And President Trump can't take that sort of pressure considering their elections coming up here in the U.S. So time, to an extent, is on Iran's side.
Is it more the political pressure rather than the economic that is bearing down on the White House right now, Alan?
Well, the economic pressure is political, and President Trump sees it as political. Gasoline prices are going up. You know, pretty soon the shortages that are happening in Europe and Asia will be reaching the United States in terms of fertilizer, diesel, jet fuel, LPG. So it's essentially economics, but it has political repercussions.
A shipping data company, Alan, is reporting that Iran has created a government agency to vet and tax vessels seeking passage through the strait. How hard will it be to unpick that?
Yeah, that's very tough. One of the unfortunate consequences of this war is that the Iranians realized that they could have real strategic deterrence by controlling the Strait of Hormuz and also monetizing it. They need a lot of money to build back their country. And so they're constructing this tolling system for all ships going through the Persian Gulf. It's going to be unfortunate if it exists, but it seems to be a necessity, at least in the short term, if we want to get the strait back open.
So could we still be months away from some sort of meaningful change to fully reopen the strait?
You know, Sally, if the strait were fully, you know, if Iran tomorrow announces the strait's fully reopened, it will still take months in terms of the global supply chains to get close to where we were before, with about 130 ships going, you know, through the Strait of Hormuz each day. So, yeah, best case, we're months away.
Mm. Alan, you were part of President Obama's team, which negotiated the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. I must ask you what it's like for you and your former colleagues watching on as this situation continues in the Middle East.
You know, it's. I'll be honest, Sally, it's a tragic own goal. There was no reason for this to happen. And now we've made everything a lot harder because in addition to having to solve the nuclear issue, which existed before this war started, we now have a whole new issue with a lot more time sensitive, which is the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. So, yeah, it's a bleak day. One person I talked to called this superpower suicide, which is perhaps accurate.
Alan Eyre there, a former US diplomat who was part of the president's 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Well, this morning we also heard from the government on this. We spoke with Senator Katie Gallagher. I've always got to take a breath when I say her title because she is the Minister for Finance, the Minister for Public Service, the Minister for Government Services, and also the Minister for Women. And given it was the top story around this morning, Sally kicked off asking her about Iran's claims that the US had violated the ceasefire.
Well, we've obviously been following developments in the Middle East closely. We've consistently called for de-escalation and have welcomed the ceasefire. So any news that, and we acknowledged it's fragile, but any news that there's been developments on that front and kind of breaking of a ceasefire would be deeply concerning. We continue to urge all parties to de-escalate and to respect the ceasefire.
Last night, women and children with links to former ISIS fighters began arriving in Australia, almost 2 weeks after leaving a refugee camp in Syria. What plans does the government have to deal with the return of this group, Minister?
Well, as the police AFP Deputy Commissioner outlined last night, and I think the Commissioner yesterday, plans have been developed since 2014, really, to manage the return of people from these countries. Indeed, around 45 men, including fighters, have returned to Australia from 2013 to 2021. So this will be handled in the way that that was handled, as you would expect. This is managed absolutely appropriately by the police and by our intelligence agencies. The government remains briefed on all aspects of that, of course, as you would expect, and we follow that advice very closely.
Are the children in this cohort in any way responsible for their situation?
Well, I think we've consistently said the parents of these children have made a terrible decision to either take those children or have children in these camps or in these war zones. And, you know, those children, I think, are going to need a lot of assistance to reintegrate into Australia. They are Australian citizens. They are, you know, obviously have entitlement to Australian citizenship, but we would, support the efforts of the state governments, the police, and the intelligence agencies to make sure those children are supported and managed appropriately.
Government Minister Senator Katie Gallagher there. Now, before we go, we also covered this story of the Islamic State-affiliated women returning to Australia with our Friday political panel. Karen Middleton is a political journalist with The Monthly, and she talked to Sally about how this is playing out politically.
There's complicated politics here with these women and also the fate of their children, those who have returned.
There certainly are, and that's why it's taken so long for them to get back, because it's the domestic politics of this that has really dominated this whole issue. There's been pressure from other countries on Australia for a long time through successive US administrations in particular to take responsibility for the Australian citizens who went to join ISIS or to join partners who were with ISIS. And this is finally the Australian nation doing that. The security agencies have assured us that they can manage this situation. I think everyone would welcome, if there are allegations that these people have broken Australian law, that everyone would welcome that they are being charged and will face justice. And that is, I suppose, a sign that the agencies are onto this and will monitor these people. But they are Australians, and for all the suggestion that they have to, you know, they can be kept out, it's very difficult to keep them out of the country. There's one woman who's been on a temporary exclusion order, but the agencies have said they can't apply that to the others. They don't meet the test. They don't meet the standard. So they're back, they'll face justice, and that's a good thing, I think.
And that was Karen Middleton, ending today's episode of The Breakfast Wrap. Well, thank you so much for listening to all those interviews right across the week from Sally Sara. Our brilliant Radio National Breakfast team puts it together every single day, and they're steered by our executive producer, Eleni Saltis. We also had Jason Whittaker in the EP chair this week. Now, before I go, I've been dying to mention this all program, but on David Attenborough's 100th birthday, he has been sent a whole number of extraordinary gifts from right around the world. But I think this one might take the cake. London's Natural History Museum has named a parasitic wasp after the broadcaster, and they've named it Attenboroughnculus tau. So, to celebrate 100 years of David Attenborough, here is a little bit more about the newly named insect and its parasitoid lifestyle. Enjoy.
So this is a lifestyle which involves the wasp paralysing a host insect or spider, temporarily or permanently, and they lay an egg on it, or in it, and then its young eat the host alive.
I'm Luke Sydenham-Dunton. Happy 100th birthday to David Attenborough. We'll see you all on Monday.